So, as I said in the beginning, but introducing myself again in case for folks who came in while we were sitting, I'm Sean Fay Oaks. I'm a teacher at Spirit Rock and around the Bay Area here. My background is in the arts. I'm a musician and dancer originally, and I realized at some point that the main thing I liked about the performing arts was that the people were lovely and kind and just beautiful people to be with. And at a certain point, I realized that being with the people was the main thing that I liked, and that I wasn't all that into performing. So bit by bit, I made quieter and quieter music and more and more, less and less busy dancing until the very last piece I ever made. And before retiring, I suppose, was a completely silent pitch black box where people could go in and have 10 minutes of sensory deprivation with me inside. And so we would talk a little or just be in silence. So I come from that background, from the arts, and have been practicing primarily at Spirit Rock for the last 20 years. Before that, I began in Zen practice. I was drawn into Zen because I loved the Chinese nature poets. And through the course of those decades, partly on the encouragement of teachers like Jack, I went to train in trauma and trauma counseling modalities. So I did somatic experiencing and organic intelligence. And also had a long practice of hatha yoga. I practiced and taught yoga for many years. And the yoga and the dancing kind of enfolded into a kind of somatic approach to practice. And through the course of practicing and studying in this way, I, along with many folks in my extended community, came into more and more of an awareness of the growing conversations that have been happening for the last many decades, really for my whole life, but growing in the last couple of decades around the large scale challenges faced by our world, particularly by American culture that I grew up in. I grew up here in California in the Bay Area, in a very liberal and progressive place. And then I ended up in the arts, in dance and performance art, which was more radical even than a kind of progressive liberal stance. So I've been way out there on the left, this full disclosure. And learning as part of that long education around the importance of the what we would call in the Buddhist world the relative reality. So in the relative world, we all carry identities and social positions. And so some of those that I carry at the moment are that I was adopted at birth and I was raised by white folks. So I mostly have in my life considered myself white. I found out when I was in my early 20s that my birth parents were, one was mostly English and the other was Puerto Rican. And so I grew into really questioning, like, you know, what does it mean if someone comes along and just, you know, tells you that you're, Latino, when you've already established an identity? I'm like, I'm just a nice white kid from California. And they're like, yeah. No, you're actually, you know, your dad was actually, you know, in a Puerto Rican gang in the Bronx. And I'm like, really? Oh, you know, good to know. And a decade after that, I actually found out that on my adoptive side, my grandfather was Jewish. Never knew. No one ever told me. I was like, come on, you never told me. And they were like, oh, well, he converted. As if that was like end of story, right? So I carry those as markers of relationship, really, in the world. I carry the behavioral markers in a certain way of having a significant amount of cisgendered male privilege within patriarchy and heterosexual privilege within heteropatriarchy, as a term you might have come across. But my behavior doesn't entirely bear that out. And so I'm a queer man in a straight marriage. So significant privilege, but a different positionality than some in those kinds of marriages. And so I carry that as well. I'm happy to say that at the end of a beautiful Pride month. Happy Pride to everyone who celebrated that in whatever way through June. And to ping back the peace around the land that we touched into in the meditation. I'm here in Northern California. And for most of the last few decades, I've lived on what has traditionally been Ohlone land, Chechenyo Ohlone land in the East Bay, and before that, Ramaytush Ohlone land in San Francisco. Just recently, I've moved up to Sonoma County, north of the city. And so now I'm right on the border of Coast Miwok and Southern Pomo ancestral lands. So I've begun, as we did in the meditation, to include not just acknowledging that, which I think is very important to do, and the presence of those people still here in our communities working to serve the land and preserve the culture of their peoples here. But I've actually found that it weaves beautifully into this very meditation that I, in a sense, began my practice with. In the Zen tradition, the very first meditation instructions you get are about posture. I arrived, they said, I'm glad you're here. You know, here's your black robe. Can you sit in lotus posture? I was like, not really. They were like, half lotus will do. That's what we got at that time. And like, yeah, okay, you know. It was not friendly to all bodies, but I was privileged enough to be able to make it within that system for a little while. And from those initial instructions in posture, with which many of us get as our first instructions, you know, how to sit in meditation. From there, the life in dancing and working with the life of the place around me led to the sense of, oh, there's the body in its posture. There's the body in its place. There's the person in its place. There's the person in relationship. And when I start to think about this thing that we hear a lot in meditation, you know, let's become present. Let's become present. What does it mean to be present? Like, well, I'm present in this physical place, and I'm present in this temporal place. And the way I've come to say that is we are practicing to be more embodied or more fully awake in the here and now. So the here is the physical, the now is the temporal. And so being present in physical space is not just my body, but it turns out to be my body in the room with everything this room means, all of the resources that went into this room happening. It also means who else is here, you know? It's really different to sit in the hall with 100 people, all breathing around you, you know, all germs spreading around you. No, but you know, yes, right? Being real bodies, animal bodies in a space, it's really different to be here, to be where I am, where you are. I'm in my home, you know, you're in your home or your office or your place, wherever you are. And so part of what can happen if we take the meditation instructions really I don't want to say seriously as if it's not serious to take it another way, but almost like if we take them subtly or mystically, to be present means a lot. And so I want to talk tonight about how the basics of our practice, of meditation practice, of Buddhist practice, point to a way of being in the world, a way of cultivating the heart and mind, that is, if we really feel into it, a profound meditation on existence in the world. I think this is what the Buddha points to when he says, you know, essentially, keep the precepts and be generous, and then cultivate mindfulness, like notice what you're doing and notice its effects, right? Study the practice of action and its effects. And what will happen is you'll notice who you are, who other people are, change, the process of how we influence each other. I want to propose that the most basic instructions in meditation practice, taken as mystical pointers, open us to a profoundly different way of being in the world. This is the claim that the texts and the ancient teachers make, and that many modern teachers make. But we can get really lost in the moment-to-moment troubles of practice. Practicing is hard. Dealing with the anxious mind, the restless mind and body, hard, not easy. And, you know, just sitting still, not easy. The body aches and hurts and complains and itches and aches some more. You know, and then every once in a while, something really lovely happens and you're like, whoa, this is great. Meditation is great. I'm so blissful. And then you get all knocked off balance by that for a while. It's not easy, even on a personal, you know, individual, simple level. The psychology isn't easy. You know, silence isn't easy. And so we might think that we have to master the personal, the individual, the silence piece, the posture, before we can do anything else. But it's not true. If we had to master that first, it would be a very long path. It is a very long path, especially if you take, you know, multiple lifetimes into account, which the Buddha did. I'm not going to try to convince you of that tonight, but, you know, come to other places than I might. It's complex, but it's part of the teachings. But it is a long path. You know, the Buddha calls it the gradual path to the elimination of suffering, to the uprooting of the defilements, to the complete end of grief, of pain, of suffering, of despair. So what might he be pointing to? I'm going to talk tonight about particularly a term that has been showing up lately in the social political field, the term collective liberation. And this has become a bit of a debate in Buddhist circles. You know, is there such a thing as collective liberation? Buddhist scholars debating the literal meaning of the texts can really take this apart and be like, how exactly does karma work? That's not what I'm going to talk about. You can look those up. I want to talk about the sense that we can have living in the contemporary world, the way that that justice is being talked about, the way that our culture is wrestling with deep challenges of like how to be, how to exist, how to be good humans, you know, in a time of really quite intense crises, you know. In a time when the climate emergency is heating up, the racial justice emergency is continuing to unfold in, you know, waves of of intensity and settling and intensity and settling for decades, you know, since the civil rights movement, since the Civil War, since the beginning of the colonial period. This is an old struggle. And in, you know, we could name so many aspects of the current conversation, challenges around essentially how a large group of people can live in close proximity. And at this point, the globe is close proximity. And be sane almost with each other, with all the differences that we carry. And this is partly why I wanted to speak right away to the social identities. You know, I'm cisgendered, I'm queer, I'm in a straight marriage, I have quite a bit of white privilege, although I'm mixed race by some folks' accounting. I'm on Southern Pomo land. My original people are from Spain and England, whatever original means. The English side might have at one point been what we would call indigenous to the British Isles. The Spanish side might have been indigenous to the Iberian Peninsula, but might actually have come from North Africa and other Moorish territory east of there. There may be an old Jewish line coming through Spain. The reason I mention these and in a sense bow to them, the relative reality, is that I want us to begin to feel how the difference between individual practice or personal practice and what we could think of as collective practice, and therefore the difference between individual pain and collective pain, or individual liberation and collective liberation, is not as wide a gulf as we might think, and as some contemporary arguments propose. So here's a way we can begin to think about this. In the Buddhist tradition, very often the beginning of a proposal for how we might live better or how we might practice, the beginning of a proposal around practice starts with the acknowledgement of pain. And the Buddha laid out the Four Noble Truths. The first truth is the truth of pain. The word is dukkha. That's the Pali term that's often translated as suffering. But it has a range of meanings that includes suffering, a kind of psychological suffering. But it also includes straight up pain. It also includes subtler kinds of pain or dissatisfaction. I like dissatisfaction sometimes as a translation for it. Like not getting what you want. That's dukkha. Getting something you didn't want, you know, like a terrible disease. That's dukkha. Losing something that you cherish is dukkha. And so we begin by acknowledging pain. Very often, this truth of dukkha, of pain, is explored in the Buddhist world as a primarily physical, psychological pain. Right? I'm in pain because I want something to be different. I'm in pain because I'm grasping onto how things were. You know, I wish that they wouldn't change, that kind of thing. All of that is painful, right? That's, we could call that personal dukkha. But think about some of these big painful things, right? The big painful things that fill the newspapers, that fill the news feed, that fill some of our social media feeds, that fill the neighborhood, depending on where you are, that fill our conversations. The pain of racial discrimination, the pain of homophobia, the pain of national hatred for those of another nation, tribalism in various forms. The pain of you know, a kind of speciesism that's behind the climate crisis. You know, like, it doesn't matter what happens to other species of animals as long as humans get what we want. You know, the pain of different kinds of social division, right? Discrimination against kind of any group that is identified by a quality that's outside the center of power. The discrimination against trans folks, discrimination against women within patriarchy, discrimination against, you know, folks with less material resources in, you know, under capitalism or a culture that favors the wealthy, discrimination against differently abled folks within an ableist society, discrimination against older folks within a youth-obsessed society. Whatever the center of power is, we can identify a kind of violence, sometimes literal, often literal, sometimes psychological or, you know, other forms, perpetrated toward groups or qualities even, right, that are on the margins of that. So there's a violence toward queer folks, whether or not, you know, any individual queer person experiences it in a certain way or a different way. Everyone experiences what they experience differently, right? I have a very different life as a queer man than other queer men that I know. It's central to the Buddha's vision of the world that conditions are extraordinarily complex. And so even if you share a lot of qualities with somebody, you know, I'm an older white man, you're an older white man, I'm a young BIPOC queer person, you're a young BIPOC queer person, you can share a lot of qualities and find some resonance in a certain kind of oppression or pain or experience. And then other things you won't share. You know, oh, I was adopted, you were not adopted. Oh, I was more middle class and you were more working class, whatever it happened, whatever it was. It's infinitely variable, but all of it is dukkha. All of it is painful. And so then we can say, oh, there's a first noble truth. That is, there's collective dukkha. There are forms of pain that are shared by large groups of people, right? I share a certain understanding of the dukkha with, for instance, you know, other mixed race folks, because that's different from, you know, the dukkha of, you know, Black folks in America or Asian folks in America or, you know, dukkha, pain, suffering, has a particular quality when it's shared in the collective. And I want to point to two aspects of this. One is that there can be a recognition that it's impersonal. And this can be both a relief and challenging, right? When I recognize that there's a kind of oppression that is generalized in this culture toward queer folks, for instance, and I know that that's true. I know that that's true more from hearing the experiences of other folks than my own. I didn't find my own experience to be substantially made more painful by other people recognizing my queerness. But I know folks whose experience, you know, was very much that way. Having learned that, there's something about the pain of that is not owned by any individual. It's shared. And so there's a collective there. And we might even say there's a collective self there. And those of you who've been around Buddhist ideas for a while, you might get that I'm heading toward a kind of radical teaching, right? That the self is not just individual. That there are aspects of myself that are shared. The pain is shared. So, collective dukkha. Pain can be collective. collective pain then would unfold. We would respond to it, right? The thing that we do with dukkha in Buddhist practice is we try to understand it, and then we try to respond wisely to it. And so understanding often involves education. I want to learn about racism. I want to learn about homophobia. I want to learn about colonialism. You know, I want to learn about how wealth works and, you know, in this world. I want to learn about the ecosystem and how it functions. I want to understand dukkha. You know, I want to understand what greed led to things being this way. What hatred, what delusion, these are the three poisons or defilements. What led to this? I want to understand that. So the task for dukkha or pain or suffering is that it's to be understood. I want to understand collective pain. Both the pain that I experience, but also the pain that I see others experience. Because pain is shared, it can be understood in a shared way, right? So I'm part of a community at the moment that's having a contentious conversation online about racism and anti-racism. And it's painful. People are getting their feelings hurt. People are sharing good resources, less good resources. But it's a basically a good faith conversation among people with different views. And it's painful because conversations about racism right now are painful for many of us. I feel like this is collective practice. So pain needs to be responded to by practice. Individual dukkha, oh, I'm not getting what I want, needs to be responded to by individual practice. Like, I can feel that, I understand it, and I'm willing to bear it so that it can be released in my system. I'm willing to, as we say, casually, but it's not so easy, let go. I'm willing to let go. This chair is a little uncomfortable. I'm not going to trouble about it. I'm going to let go. That's individual practice. I'm going to bear it. I'm going to explore it. I'm going to be with it. I'm going to try to move the energy as best I can. Collective practice. My community is struggling with this conversation on racism. Some people are speaking skillfully. Some people are speaking less skillfully. By and large, they're doing all right. I was reading some of the emails, and for a little bit, I was like, oh God, I hate these things on email. It's a terrible medium for doing this kind of thing. And then I was like, a community of a couple hundred people is trying to have a difficult conversation in the best medium we have at the moment. Like, good going, people. Like, really, this is collective practice. So we could ask for every one of our big practice instructions, what is the collective version of this? What is collective mindfulness? So what would it be, for instance, for a group of people to become aware of something that they weren't previously aware of? You know, I'm thinking right now, if we want to keep going with race as the example, it's a helpful example nowadays. I'm thinking of the process of white folks in America becoming awake to racism, to the systemic nature of racism. In other words, it's not that they are necessarily becoming awake to their own personal racial bias. They might be, many are, but it's not actually about that. That's personal practice. Totally helpful. Please do that, all of us. But collective practice is something like the body politic or the social body of, let's say, you know, progressive white folks in America, to use one category that a few of you might belong to. I at times have felt like I belong to that category. Progressive white folks in America seem to have been waking up to, right, developing some mindfulness of the nature of racism, how it plays out, how we feel it, how we participate in it, how we might resist it. All of that is collective mindfulness. It's almost like you can track the conversation over several years progressing, and you can say, oh, the collective is starting to understand something, right? There's a collective understanding growing of around indigenous genocide in North America. And so the response to, you know, the horrific, but unfortunately predictable discovery of mass graves of children at the residential schools in Canada this past month. The response to this has been in a certain way heartening, that there's a broad consensus that this is absolutely not okay, and that it requires restitution, reparation, repair of some kind in an official capacity, in a collective way. So collective mindfulness, how does a group of people, not any one person, but a whole group of people, come into awareness of something? It's like it starts to emerge. So think for a moment, tune in for a moment to community that you belong to, maybe by one of these identity categories. You know, I'm a white person, I'm a brown person, I'm a whatever words you use. And see if you can identify, feel into for a moment, a collective pain and a collective practice. See if you can sense what a group of people that I'm part of is learning right now, practicing right now, trying to figure out, becoming aware of. And it's hard to not get personal. It's hard to not be like, I'm coming, becoming aware of this. See if you can be like, no, my people, right, are becoming aware of this, are practicing with this. Take just a moment with that. I'm going to turn the lights up in here because the sun is going down. And I'll resume in about 30 seconds. All right, so we're sensing into a group that I have some participation in, a pain that's held by that group, and a practice that's unfolding in that group. And it can be a beautiful investigation to think about any aspect of practice, how it's unfolding in the collective body rather than my individual body. For instance, you know, take samadhi, which is the name for meditative stillness. You know, I practice mindfulness of breathing, and I let the thoughts settle as best I can. I come into bodily presence, connect with the breath, and then I stay there in as continuous and steady and relaxed a way as I can, cultivating a kind of deep stillness and a letting go of the external chatter for a little bit. That's samadhi practice, or steadying the heart-mind practice. So how might we think about a community practicing samadhi? How does a collective become calm? How does a collective focus on something and stay with it? So you might just feel into, what are ways that you've seen perhaps a group of people cultivate this quality as a group, not as individuals, but as a group? In a way, some of the first examples that come to me when I think about this, you know, mindfulness in a certain way is easier, right? You can see, partly because it's more verbal, you can see a community understanding something, partly because they're talking about it, you know, but you can see it in media. Think of media as the visible, you know, mental chatter of a collective. It's like, well, my collective, as exemplified by the mental chatter of, you know, the Washington Post and the New York Times and my Facebook feed and any number of other organs of chatter, I'm just going to call them organs of chatter at this point. I can tell what they're thinking. Like, well, we're thinking a lot about, you know, we're thinking a lot about vaccines, and we're thinking a lot about self-help, and we're thinking a lot about racism, and we're thinking a lot about, you know, the Line 3 pipeline. And, you know, it's like, I can notice the chatter of my collective mind. And having noticed that, Now I want to look for what are the ways that the collective has an orientation towards stillness. And I think this is harder to find because stillness is not as valued in this culture. I can find a lot of places where my collective is trying to understand and orienting toward action, and that's helpful. I don't find a lot of places where my collective is oriented toward stillness. But I think about communities that value it. And I think about, for instance, my child. I have a 5-year-old. He goes to this really sweet, very progressive school here in Sonoma County. And one of their values is being media free. So they try really hard to shelter the kids who are in early childhood, like, you know, through kindergarten, et cetera, the early years, from screens and media influences. You know, they don't want them to wear superhero shirts with like big brand names to school. And they ask us as parents to keep them off screens as much as we can. And some of us succeed more or less at that daunting task nowadays. But the result of that, in part, is that my child's environment in his school, but also in his playgroups and his friend circles, is not saturated with a certain kind of reference. It has a different pace, nervous system-wise. And being a meditator who's focused on nervous system practice and regulation, I like that. I share that value of keeping his world a little more analog for a little bit longer. I have friends in the more radical political world who will do like a mainstream news fast, and who will say, like, I'm only getting my news from direct human conversation with people whose values I share. I'm not reading the Post, the Times, the whatever. I'm not gonna imbibe that chatter. I'm actually gonna say to my friends who, you know, like, hey, what are we tracking? And in between those conversations, I'm actually not gonna engage with that. I'm doing my work, I'm doing something else. And then when a whole group of people does that and starts to normalize that, you know, then you start to get a collective practice. On a bigger scale, I'm thinking about, you know, folks like the Amish, for instance. And I wasn't sure I wanted to say it as an example because it's a lifestyle that's far away from many of our lifestyles. But, you know, there's a monastic wing of Buddhist practice. I go to visit the monastics up at Abayagiri, which is a Buddhist monastery here in California in the Thai forest style. And it's a place where, you know, there's the rhythm is slower. It's just, you have a conversation with the monks, you have a meal, you're not on your screen, you're not on your phone, you're not busy in that way. There's a whole collective attempt to make a field of stillness. There is collective practice. The last thing I'll say about collective practice is that even stillness is difficult to find in some of our current collectives. You have to go to kind of religious collectives often to find it, you know, spiritual groups, retreats often, you know, meditation retreat is a place to find a collective stillness, you know, and if you've been on long retreat at Spirit Rock or somewhere like it, you know that the stillness you feel in a hall full of people cultivating stillness is very different than the stillness you might feel alone in your room, even if your room is quieter. Even if in the Spirit Rock Hall, people are shuffling and moving around and coughing and somebody's crying and somebody's giggling, and usually not, but you know, every once in a while, a giggle fit passes through the room. It's not as quiet and empty as your room, but not everybody in the room is quiet at the same time. Some people are super distracted, having a terrible time, you know, mad hindrance attack. Somebody else is really deep and they don't even know, you know, where they are, and you know, everything in between. But you're going to feel the collective stillness, and it's palpably different than individual stillness, which is why it's so powerful to go on retreats, so helpful for individual practice. So there's collective pain
There's collective practice. How do groups of people meet that pain in a way that's effective? And then this challenging term that I want to finish with, collective liberation. In the Buddhist system, the idea with dukkha, with pain, suffering, dissatisfaction, discontent, is that when dukkha is understood, the underlying impulses that perpetuate it will be released. In other words, as soon as you understand that your actions are contributing to this thing being painful, you'll stop doing those things. And unfortunately, that's really simplistic, and trauma gets in the way of that in all sorts of ways. Oppression gets in the way of that in all sorts of ways, right? Particularly the way that collective pain, collective dukkha, is difficult to uproot, right? Like a lot of people in a community have to really want to work on being anti-racist before the community expresses anti-racism, right? There has to be a tipping point that that isn't just individuals. You may have been the individual in a room where you're like, hey, I see an important thing here, you know, and it's not going to land. But if it's a room of 100 people and 15 of you say, I see an important thing here, you know, and it turns out there's some percentage that folks added up. It turns out that, you know, somewhere between like 3 and 5% of a collective is often enough to tip it toward change. That's enough. It's a room of 100 people. If 4 people stand up and are like, something important needs to be seen here, it will be seen, you know? And if the conditions are ripe, the whole collective can shift when that happens. Collective liberation, I think, points to something like the moral evolution or deep wisdom arising that arises on the community or cultural level, not necessarily on the individual level. So I'll propose that there's, let's use as an example, because I want to think that this battle's been won. It hasn't quite, but I want to use, I'll use marriage equality as an example. When I first heard about the fight for marriage equality, it was not legal for gay people to marry almost anywhere in the United States. And as many of you will know, anyone who's tracked that process, it not only snowballed for a while there until gay marriage was legal in many, many places here, but there's been a generational shift where when they poll young people across the political spectrum, including in very conservative communities, there's a huge majority in favor of marriage equality. In a certain way, the collective explored that pain, understood it, practiced with it, and came to some solution for it that's pleasing to a lot of people. That doesn't mean that everyone, every individual here, is into it, as of course you know, right? Lots of folks aren't into it. But perhaps it has shifted, you know, in public opinion. There's been a collective liberation to a certain extent from that ancient ghost. And so I think what we can look for is that the basic practices that the Buddhist system proposes, right? Get present, get steady, speak clearly, and stop doing the things that hurt. Four Noble Truths, right? Very, very simple, right? Understand pain, understand why the pain is painful. Right, understand what's causing it. Stop doing that. And it stops. That formula works just as well thinking about collectives as individuals. And the last little punchline that I'll leave you with here is that the category individual is pretty difficult to sustain. So maybe versions of collective liberation is all there is. You know, what is greed? It's Like, well, what is this thing where my heart wants something? I learned it. You know, where did I learn that from? It's like, well, I learned it from this culture, from these people, from this place. That was gifted to me. Thank you very much. I would like to set that down now. You know, that often quoted piece, you know, around little children not being racist, right? Like, racism has to be learned. It doesn't make innate sense that people of a certain skin color should be, you know, better or worse than another skin color. But we teach that, right? That gets taught. And it gets learned very young. My child is starting to learn it, you know, and we're working very hard to train a moral center in him that is in line with the precepts, that's in line with our values. Collective liberation, I think, happens when collective pain is recognized, collective practice gets some traction, and the collective, a group of people, actually attains this letting go. This thing that happens when the heart understands the process of why painful things are done and doesn't want to do that anymore, right? When the individual no longer has the impulse to cause harm, when so many individuals together, sharing weight, sharing impulse, sharing intention, sharing volition, vow in a certain way that a thing should end, then it, according to the Dhamma, anyway, the teachings of the Buddha, you know, when it's seen so clearly, it must end. It must end. You know, the teaching about liberation for, you know, in the texts is that the fully liberated being cannot do something that harms another being. Like, they can't generate a thought of greed, hatred, or delusion. Because the understanding is so deep that once you understand what's going to hurt somebody, you would not do it. The thought wouldn't even cross your mind. Greed has been uprooted. Hatred has been uprooted. What might it be like for a particular greed or hatred to be uprooted in the body politic, in the collective, such that it is, as the Buddha says in the Pali texts, no longer subject to arising? The Buddha describes the process of uprooting a defilement like trying to make a palm tree no longer grow. He says, if you want to destroy a palm tree so that it no longer grows, you cut it down, you chop it into tiny bits, you burn those tiny bits, and then you scatter the ashes far and wide. And a friend of mine who's a gardener said, oh yeah, that's exactly what you have to do, you know, with a really invasive plant. What kind of practice will it take for the collective of humans now to abandon, to uproot, to make subject to no longer arising the ancient demon of racial bias, the ancient demons of greed for resources that fuel the climate emergency, the fuel resource deprivation, the ancient demons that fear difference such that hatred arises in the presence of that which is different. So, and with just a little prayer that we not be afraid of what happens when we turn our attention from the self to the collective. We don't take anything personally, but we bear in ourselves the weight of the whole to the extent that we are capable. So that we can play our tiny part. Right? We don't bear individually the weight of the whole, but we share, it's a better way to say it, that we share the weight of the whole with so many others. And the more the weight is shared, the more the weight can be lifted. take just a few minutes here for, we'll take a couple of questions and reflections here. Anything that arises in you as you feel into this. You can use your electronic hand raising, or you can type a question into the chat. Linda, please.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, well, partially you may have answered some of this. As a longtime Buddhist practitioner, I know we try to understand and practice both individual and collective understanding. Recently in my own family, a younger member is investigating gender neutrality. And part of my question, actually there's several, they kind of flow one into another, and I'm sure you'll understand. How can you get past systemic racism, prejudice, and training from that was ingrained in you from your own parents who had their own prejudices? Mm-hmm. I try to practice mindfulness, yet find I still fall back on judgments in various situations based on family influences. But I'd like to know how you can get past these innate prejudices to shift both individual and a collective awareness.
Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful question, Linda. Thank you. One of the ways that I like to think about this is that I think of many of you will know the list of the five hindrances. So sense desire, ill will or hatred, restlessness and worry, sloth and torpor or dullness, and doubt. The five classic hindrances to meditation. I think of these as trauma symptoms. In other words, I inherited a tendency toward anxiety. I inherited, for lots of reasons, maybe it was direct. My mom was anxious. My dad was anxious, whatever. Maybe it was an attachment thing. I was in fact adopted, wherever it came from, right? I inherited that. So when anxiety is present in me, I could log it as a hindrance. I could say there's restlessness, there's worry, anxiety. I could also log it as a trauma symptom that is ancestral and inherited. Well, I come from, a whole line of troubled people. God bless them. But it's true. Seeing it that way, everything that, not everything, but, a huge amount of what troubles me is actually inherited, exactly as you're saying. I don't want to be prejudiced, but I inherited these views. Okay. What's the instruction for dealing with a hindrance? Notice it. So become mindful of it, right? Hindrances are part of the fourth foundation of mindfulness. So become mindful of it. And then in the foundations of mindfulness, the instructions for the hindrances are figure out what conditions cause it to diminish and be prevented from arising, right? So say, okay, there's anxiety arising. How do I diminish that? Well, it helps if I get enough sleep, if I eat well, if I, whatever it is for any of y'all, right? If I take my meds, if I do enough exercise, if I talk to my friend every day, what's going to help? So here's a hindrance called prejudice. It's going to be a form of aversion, essentially, trained, right? You didn't invent this. It was taught. That means, first of all, what do we have to do to get rid of blame and shame around it? Because you don't own it, right? It's like, this came down through my line. So first of all, compassion, mindfulness that it's present. And then when there's a hindrance present, we can apply an antidote. When the anxious mind is present, I actually apply the antidote of increasing my energy and concentrating a little bit, which is a little anti-intuitive, right? What I want to do is relax, but actually if I loosen up on the reins, my mind really doesn't help. So concentration actually is the antidote to restlessness. Concentrate. So then we might say, what's the antidote to prejudice? You know, it might be, you know, it, for you, it might be metta. It might be like, oh, when that thought comes in, and it is really microscopic. It's not just like, oh, in a very broad way, I do metta, and then I just hope the hindrance won't arise. You know what hindrances are like, right? They are persistent weeds, right? So it's going to mean something like, I learn for myself what the antidote is, and then my life is a meditation. Like every time I'm talking to this person, I'm aware of like, oh, here comes that hindrance. And I want to respond well to it, you know? And somehow I'm going to say to myself, I'm going to say to the hindrance, the way the Buddha said to Mara, the deceiver, you know, I see you, discrimination. I disown you. You no longer belong in my lineage. I reject you as a force. You know, I don't believe your message, whatever you have to say. And you just kind of do that in the background, you know? And that might mean that your engagement with this person is a little bit constrained for a while. You might be like, what I try to do is be really polite, careful about pronouns, and listen more than speak. It's a great practice anyway, you know? But largely the principle here is that the thing that is difficult to deal with, it's just a hindrance. And hindrances all have, you know, skillful, you can respond skillfully to any hindrance, but you got to figure out what that is. And when it's a really deep ancestral trauma or an inherited trauma, which this is, it takes a while to find the best antidote, you know? And sometimes, you know, the antidote is going to be collective, right? I'm sure in 3 seconds in a search engine, you could find, you know, a support group for relatives of a gender transitioning person or a, you know, and you would find that. You would find people writing about that. And that would be also, education is an antidote, but it's going to come down to you and your mind. This is for all of us now, right? You want to uproot an ancient weed or demon or, you know, force. It's going to take persistence. You know, like any hindrance, returning to it again and again and again. Lots of compassion, lots of patience. And then you just try to keep your precepts in the external.
Yeah, thank you. I hadn't really thought about things coming through in a lineage sense. I mean, yes, I understand about the prejudices and racism and whatever that my parents had and maybe their parents and whatever, but I hadn't thought of that as being directly affecting us in the here and now, in the sense that it wasn't our fault. We didn't cause it. We didn't necessarily choose it, but it was there in our experiential background. So thank you for clarifying that. I truly appreciate it.
Awesome. Yeah. Blessings to your family member and to yourself as well.
Thank you. You too.
Time for one more. Or two if they're short and interesting. All right, last call. And you get an ancient chant, magic spell, close. All right, you get the magic spell. So to close us, I want to chant a passage that many of us, many of you who have practiced at Spirok will have heard, some of you may not have. This is a chant known as the sharing of blessings. And I want to chant it, not just because it's lovely to chant and it's an encouragement for deepening in practice, but actually because I want you to listen to it with the ears of the collective and really listen for the way that this chant actually points to the benefit of our practice going out to the collective. And it's not individual and direct. It's not like, you know, it says my practice, but listen to what we're invoking. And it turns out to be this vast field of beings. So let's see here. You know, I want to pull it up and then so that you can see it, and then we'll And we'll do it and we'll close. Elves behind the scene, I'm gonna screen share something. All right, so this might be a little small for some of y'all, but on the right side of the screen here, this is gonna be the sharing of blessings. As we did before, I'll just sing it. Listen for the way that this is a magic spell, extending the mystery of the power, the results of our practice out to a wide swath of beings, including evil forces. Close our evening sharing blessings. Now let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent, or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nibbana in every kind of birth. May I have an upright mind, with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble guide. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled. So, blessings to everyone here. Lovely to spend the evening with you, or whatever time of day or night it is, where you are on the planet. You can join me on the Friday and Saturday, the 16th and 17th, with Kate Johnson for a weekend on somatic practice and meditation, focusing on pleasure and power and ease in practice. And you can put on your calendars a day long on September 11th, where we'll look at the six realms theory and Buddhist psychology. My regular sitting group is on Tuesday evenings, and you can find that on my website. And it's lovely to be with you. Blessings, stay safe, may you be well, and may our collective be well, and may our collective grow in the Dhamma for the well-being of all. Thank you.